Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Hello, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum and your chairman for today. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org and view the online calendar of upcoming club events. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our panel for today, Conscious Capitalism Part 2. I'm going to introduce each of our speakers and ask them an opening question, and from there we will then go to questions between the panelists, and then we'll at about 40 minutes from now we will have questions from the audience. You have audience questions should have them on your seat. If not, someone will be passing them out. This is the Commonwealth Club format for questions, so please write out your questions. They'll be passed up to me, and I will ask our panelists. I'm very excited about our panel today. This program came about based on a book called Making Meaning that two of our panelists were co-authors on, along with a third author, Daryl Ray, who's not here today. But this book really started this whole conversation about what is conscious capitalism, how do you come about with meaning, what is a meaningful experience. And so that is something that we want to talk about today. I'm going to address one of our authors first, and that's Steve Diller. Steve Diller heads Cheskin's Added Values Experience Design Studio with more than 20 years of innovation and marketing consulting experience and drives the firm's innovation practice. Steve is an experienced strategist focusing on the development of meaningful experiences, be it through branding or product usage. Recent clients include the Washington Post, Gannett, MasterCard, Microsoft, Del Monte, Humana, and Procter & Gamble. Earlier in his career, Steve was a professor at Columbia College in Chicago, teaching courses on advertising and marketing psychology, social marketing, market research, media, and political propaganda. Steve also has owned a film production company and has produced and directed several feature films. So, Steve, can you tell us this book that you did, Making Meaning, and some of the conversations we've been having about this? Can you tell us what is behind that and how that whole thing came about with your work and your thinking?
Oh, started with the hard question. Okay. Well, I think it actually came from a variety of sources. When you make movies, you're an experienced designer. You have to be consciously aware of how every choice you make in terms of script, in terms of camera placement, will affect somebody. And the purpose of making a film is to affect somebody and to do it over a period of time. It's an experience because you start in one state when you sit down and begin to watch it, and you're in a different place at the end. So an experience has occurred. Somebody has designed that for you, and it may be a powerful experience. It may be an inane one. It may be one that changes your life. It may be trivial. I mean, it could be moderately interesting. But that's always been an area that's been fascinating to me, whether it was in film or whether it's what political organizations do. They also are after designing of experiences for us, and they want to cause us to act. So an experience usually involves that kind of steps that we take to interact with whatever it is that's being provided to us. So it's just been an area that's interested me for a long time. When I came to work at Cheskin, when I first got there, there was a focus on, for me, on media and media research, understanding what people got from the experience from film to newspapers, actually. And what I began to see was that if you had a conversation with a typical editor of a newspaper, whether it was at the level of the Washington Post or a regional paper, and you asked them, what do you think makes somebody savor the prospect of reading the paper in the morning, they can't tell you. They can talk about objectivity, and they can talk about balance, and they can talk about comprehensiveness to what they look at, but they can't tell you what makes you crave it. And it's the craving that makes you pay for it. Right, so it isn't just at the level of intellectual interest, but there's something else that's going on besides that that is actually the key to whether papers are successful or not, just like lots of other products are successful or not. So as we were doing work in that field, it just became clear that there was something more going on there, and we needed to understand that. And most people in business didn't seem to understand that.
And how does that relate to conscious capitalism?
Well, the thing I like about conscious capitalism, that phrase, is that it can mean lots of different things. It seems like in the previous conversation there was a focus on supply chains and sustainability, and that may be one dimension of it being conscious. When I think about conscious capitalism, I think about capitalism that provides something beyond a functional benefit for people, which is what it set out to do starting in the 19th century, and towards the end of the 20th began to be possible a whole range of other kinds of experience types that were much more powerful. And can we consciously design that for people, regardless of what we're in? The film business has set out to consciously do that for the last 100 years, but what about hotels? What about car companies? They seem to have a mixed record. In some cases, they do it exceptionally well, like Hampton, and we'll hear more about that later. But there are plenty of hotels that you wonder what kind of experience they're trying to provide, aside from return on investment for the real estate interest that they're working with. There's more to it than that. And I think that question of what can make it conscious when it's not is what interests me in particular.
Thanks, Steve. Our second panelist is Mike DePatie from Kimpton Hotels. Mike DePatie is the CEO and president of San Francisco-based Kimpton Hotel Groups. Kimpton is the largest company in the very fast-growing boutique hotel business, with 44 hotels open in the U.S. and Canada, with an additional 18 hotels currently under development. Under Mike's leadership, Kimpton takes pride in its commitment to social responsibility and leads the hospitality industry in ecological practices through its innovative Earth Care programs. Mike has been in the hospitality business for over 25 years and has been successful in building a number of innovative hospitality brands as an early member of the executive team at Residence Inn and as a co-founder of Summerfield Suites. Now, Mike, Kimpton Hotels is really a very conscious capitalistic company, isn't it? Can you tell us a little bit about Kimpton's approach and what you guys are doing that is conscious and how you are doing some things that are making you such... I mean, you guys are at the top of your field right now. How are you doing that and being conscious at the same time?
Well, I appreciate that comment. Let me just talk a little bit about Kimpton and what we do that I think makes us different. One thing that we really focus on at Kimpton is customer experience. And Steve was just talking about meaning. My sense is that where you get meaning is where experience creates a relationship with the customer. And in our case, our business, we've been in business for about 26 years now. Business started here in San Francisco, taking older buildings, often historically significant, and kind of gutting out the inside of this building that was kind of left for dead, and turned into a four and a half star, highly designed boutique hotel with a chef-driven restaurant. And so with that as kind of a product, we're all about experience. When our customer comes in our doors, sees great design, that's starting to engage them emotionally. Then they maybe go to our restaurants, and that's, food has a lot of emotional connections for people. So we have a lot of ways that we're going to connect with them emotionally. The company is, we've always been eco-sensitive. I mean, we're in the business of recycling old buildings. I mean, it's part of the ethic of the company. So that the values of the company, we're pet-friendly. We're into a lot of things that our customers are into. Like, for example, we're into wellness. We have a 24-hour wellness channel that's free, where you can have free video on Pilates or meditation. These are the kind of things that they care about. So part of creating a memorable experience, and I think deeper from experience into meaning, is about developing that relationship with that customer. And I think the real thing that's different about us, what I'd like to talk more about when I get the opportunity, is the way that we treat our employees. And I think the way we treat our employees and the way we care for our employees ultimately results in the way that they care for our customers. And so I'm the CEO of the company. I try to care for the people that work for me. Hopefully the people who work for me try to care for the people that work for them. And it kind of goes all down the line. You can say, well, God, that sounds kind of mushy, caring for everybody like that. What is this, a big country club? Well, my concept of care is care with accountability. And when I say that I care for the guys that work for me, I mean, I care from, like, if Steve was my brother, I say, Steve, I'm expecting some things from you, and I saw the stuff you did last week, and it wasn't very good.
Tough love.
Because I care about him. If I didn't care about him, I wouldn't say anything. And so sometimes we care so much for people, we ask them to leave. And you know what? That's the best thing we can do. So kind of putting this all together, though, is creates a package of kind of unique product offering that I don't think anybody else in our business is really doing. I'm glad to talk about it because I don't think anybody can copy us very easily.
Thank you. Our next panelist is Steve's co-author of Making Meaning, Nathan Shedroff. Nathan Shedroff is the chair of the groundbreaking MBA in Design Strategy at California College of the Arts. As in his career, this new program melds the unique principles that design offers business strategy with a vision of the future of business as sustainable, meaningful, and truly innovative, as well as profitable. He's one of the pioneers in experience design, interaction design, and information design. He speaks and teaches internationally and has written extensively on design, business, and meaning, including Experience Design 1 and Making Meaning. So, Nathan, how do you, you've got this whole MBA program. These guys want to make a buck. How do you teach them to be conscious and care about the world?
Well, I have to say we're enrolling our first cohort of students, about 31 students this fall, so we're just getting to know them right now. But we're definitely not attracting the normal MBA student that might come to mind when you hear about MBA students. Like a few other smaller, very focused MBA programs, our values are right out there on our program's website, and we're consciously trying to attract the people who care about things like meaning and sustainability and innovation as core values, not just profit and ROI, et cetera. Not that those things aren't important, but we believe those are the tools and the mechanisms you use to accomplish much more meaningful things like sustainability or building experiences that people care about. So I'm really excited because we're in essence trying to create a program to create the first generation of business leaders that understand and value and know how to implement these things. Up till now, it's all been sort of homegrown by extraordinary people in the business world and the nonprofit world, doing this either incredibly intuitively or in some cases accidentally. And the point of the book, Making Meaning, was that you can actually do it deliberately. And so I've been given this opportunity to build a program to teach people to do it deliberately. And hopefully in 5 or 10 years, we'll see if that works or not.
So there is a method you can teach people about how to make meaning and how to be conscious capitalists?
Well, I think there are tools that are being developed. In fact, you know, Cheskin's developing some right now. I think there are tools that you can use to become aware, especially as you engage customers in design research and customer research, to look for these things because it's out there. We don't have a very good vocabulary, and most people don't have very good tools to deal with the sort of soft, mushy stuff like emotions and values and how do you measure them. They're all sort of qualitative more than they are quantitative, but we are developing tools, and so the first part of that is to be aware of it and be aware of its value and then figure out how to observe and look for it, and then once you do that learning, you can figure out how to put that into your company strategy or your organization strategy. And even just to that level, you're in a position then to affect the tactics of your company and the products and services and the experiences you create for your customers.
That's great. Thank you. Our fourth panelist is Lisa Gansky. Lisa Gansky is an entrepreneur and environmentalist focused on building companies and supporting social ventures where there's an opportunity for well-timed disruption and a resounding impact. A founder and CEO of several internet companies, including GNN, the first web portal sold to AOL, and the largest consumer photo sharing and print service, OPhoto, sold to Eastman Kodak in 2001. Lisa's attention is on sustainable ventures with positive social impact. She puts a strong emphasis on clean energy, green building, ecotourism, and accelerating consumer awareness. Currently, Lisa serves as director and co-founder of Dos Margaritas, an environmental foundation with programs focused in Latin America. She's an advisor and investor in a number of social ventures, including New Resource Bank, Tastebook, Makani Power, Squidoo, and Greener World Media. From 2007, she has stepped into the role of chief strategist and director with the Michelle Kaufman Companies in Oakland, California. So, Lisa, you were in the whole internet boom. I mean, you hit the big time in the internet boom, and now you've been able to do some things that you really wanted to do, as well as help a lot of other people do that. How did that come about for you?
The rise or the fall?
Well, both. I mean, the rise and the fall, and the return to
the rise again. Well, I mean, let's see. I'm on a random walk, I would say, you know, by candor in my life. When I was an entrepreneur, which came quite natural, I sort of grew up with my religion being the nature, and so it was very easy for me to be, you know, an environmentalist and an entrepreneur at the same time. During the dot-com, or, you know, GNN was the first internet portal, so it basically was like this 93 thing that we accidentally did. not really knowing, my voice is on the way out, but not really knowing, you know, what the internet was going to be. So we were doing it because we thought it was cool, and we didn't know any better. It was really fun. And so I think for me personally, the experience was really looking at the opportunity with the internet was to kind of create a level playing field and to look at the chance to reinvent a lot of services and opportunity for access for people. For me personally, that's a theme in my life. I care a lot about, you know, lots of access. So people having access to nature, people having access to photography and sharing celebration and stuff with their family. And then, you know, again, with, you know, Michelle Kaufman, that's a good example, too, which is about making green irresistible and accessible to all. So I think in answer to your question, it really came about because it's challenging to have two parts of your life that aren't a cocktail. And so what I learned in being an entrepreneur is that you get to kind of create the culture and invite the people that you want to have play with you. And create a mission and a vision and a mood to the company. And that was very powerful for me as an entrepreneur, I think. And then you get to kind of not necessarily impose, but invite and kind of seduce other people into a vision and a mission and potentially your biases. And so, you know, we did that with Ofoto in the ways that we could, and Michelle Kaufman is a really good embodiment of that, the new resource bank. Which is a green bank in San Francisco that I'm really proud to be a part of, the same. So, you know, that's, I think, the best.
Good. Well, you were telling us in the green room beforehand about the Michelle Kaufman Company. Can you tell the audience on the radio and here a little bit more about that?
Sure, I'm happy to. Michelle Kaufman is an architect who worked with Frank Gehry for years and was extremely successful. Came to California, to Northern California, really looking for a house with her husband who was living here, and out of pure frustration that they couldn't find what they were looking for, she kind of caved and decided to make something that was, you know, super sustainable, nearly zero energy, you know, affordable, that sort of thing. And quite by accident, which I think any of us who are entrepreneurs understand the quite by accident phenomenon. She had a few friends come over her house who said, this is really cool, this is gorgeous, this is kind of like, I want one of these. And could you build one of these for me? And so she's a big brain, very charming person, and just kind of took it on as her phrase, which I really like, is, you know, construction and the way we build homes and the way we build buildings in general, construction all around, is just hasn't been rethought for many, many years, you know, hundreds. And so, in any, except for adding power tools. And so, you know, her comment, which I really like, is, well, we don't build our cars in our driveway. Why do we build our homes on our site? And if you go outside to, you know, to Asia, especially Japan and to Northern Europe, you see that the most, you know, sophisticated buildings are built, precision built in factories. And here in the United States, I think because of the HUD regulations, or however we refer to those, and the kind of pollution in our minds about factory-built with manufactured homes, we don't really appreciate the opportunity. And so with Michelle, it's basically her idea is to make green beautiful, irresistible, and accessible to all, because, you know, you can really get some real efficiencies of scale when you go to factory. And so we started there. She has built a really fabulous brand, and she's from Iowa, so she has this lovely accessibility in terms of just personality-wise, you know, being very genuine as she is with people. So I think there's a lot of times we saw it with digital photography, with the beginning of the internet. I'm sure all of you have seen it as well, that when something new emerges, like this whole green thing, it's confusing to people. Like, you don't know who to believe, you don't know what light bulbs to use, you don't know what to clean your house with, everything becomes this big source of confusion. And so to sort of turn the volume down on the fog machine of confusion, Michelle has also started to do educational things like big exhibitions. There's one in just opened this weekend at the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago that will be there for about a year and a half. There was one in San Francisco in front of the City Hall last September, and there's a blog and a bunch of things. So we're real excited about the opportunity of doing, working with different people and different communities to see how we can bring green building. And in some cases, you know, we're hoping and expecting that people aren't going to level their existing homes to build a green one, because that's not very green. So the idea would be to just really help people to start to see and think, rethink, you know, how we live and how we can live healthier and happier and more efficiently.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you. Well, Steve, we're talking about conscious capitalism. How would a meaning-oriented capitalist function, and how would that be different from what we have today?
Well, I think there's a variety of ways that they could function. I mean, on the one hand, a lot of what we've talked about so far here, pardon?
Pull your mic.
A little closer? All right. One of the things that has been talked about here a lot is issues related to sustainability and how companies can do a better job of addressing that. And we can spend all of our time addressing just the different dimensions of sustainability and how companies can think about that. And that's one area. But from the standpoint of human needs, sustainability addresses only a small area of concern that people have. And so I'm kind of going out on a limb a little bit here, but imagine 10 years from now, probably you would have the option of buying products in virtually every product category, every service that is a sustainable option. It's probably close to that already in certain categories where you can do this. So at what would distinguish companies at that point? If you think about what sustainability is about, it has to do with justice, it has to do with community, but there are a whole range of other kinds of needs that people have that make life worth living, which is what we talked about in the book when we were trying to address the question of meaning, that sustainability might not touch. So, for instance, beauty. Now, it may be a beautiful thing, to be sustainable, but strictly speaking, it doesn't necessarily have that aesthetic quality of beauty that inspires people, right? So you could have a choice between one option that, in addition to being a sustainable business, also brings beauty into your life through the use of the product, and another one may be about freedom, for instance. So we could look at Harley-Davidson and the way that it actually seems to promise the possibility of freedom through use of their products. So on the one hand, you could obtain a beauty benefit over here and a freedom benefit over here. They're both really important to people. They don't necessarily have to do directly with sustainability, but they're meaningful in other ways, right? So I think part of what can happen here is that it's not just about sustainability, though that might be not an easy way to start, but an understandable way to start. It's a lot easier to talk about sustainability in some respects in terms of processes that don't pollute or that are fair to people, indigenous peoples, for instance. It's a lot harder to talk about how to deliver freedom to somebody through a product or a service, but it can be done, or oneness. Good things we all like in California: freedom, justice, beauty, oneness, right? Well, how can that be done for people? I think that'll be the kind of task that business people, not just in the U.S., but globally, will have to deal with. And how they do that will depend on the local cultures that they're interacting with. It's not a simple matter, but it's doable. And I think increasingly it's going to not necessarily be the price of entry into a market, but it may have a lot to do with the difference between being remarkably successful and just competing on price.
Okay, well, I'm going to ask Mike a question, because your company is remarkably successful, and I know you just received a large award, a large accolade about your service, and I know you also have just personally closed a huge funding round, something like $264 million. And at the same time, you guys are launching this wonderful thing, I Am Kimpton, for your employees. So how do you make that all work and balance out?
First of all, I didn't personally close the fund. We have a team of people that do that, so they should get proper credit. And so just if I could also just point out that I'm really proud of it. that we did win this thing. Market Metrics is this company that's like the J.D. Powers of customer satisfaction in the hospitality industry, and they actually poll 35,000 people a quarter. And last year, they actually named Kimpton, who a lot of people don't even know Kimpton, but they named Kimpton the number one company in the country, brand, hotel brand in the country, for customer satisfaction, which really kind of blew me away, because we beat Four Seasons and we beat Mandarin and we beat all these guys. So the question is, you know, how are we doing that? I think it's a lot to what we do, and it's got a lot to do with this meaning and experience. And I think that, it probably was discussed in the last panel, and I kept getting 15 minutes into it, never got through the whole thing when I watched it on Fora TV. But, so it may have been discussed, so I apologize. But clearly, I think we're moving from kind of, you know, if I can be really big picture, from kind of hunters and gatherers to maybe, you know, agricultural kind of economy to an industrial kind of economy to an information-based economy. And now the big thing a couple years ago was an experience-based economy. And I think we're largely kind of in that in a lot of products, but we're transcending that in some product groups to a meaning-based economy. People want meaning in their products that they use. They want meaningful consumption, which I think is a term that maybe you guys use in your book. So, you know, we're trying our best to figure out what's the meaning that people are getting out of staying at Kimpton? I mean, staying at a hotel, can that be that meaningful? What is that? And we've hired a firm actually like Cheskin. I apologize for this. But we hired
like
a
Cheskin.
Could have been Cheskin. Cheskin-like. we hired a guy that's based up in B.C. that is a mythologist. He's a Ph.D. in mythologist and religion. And we hired him to basically go to the core of our customers that really, really love us. What is it they love about us, to try to figure out kind of where's the meaning, you know, from an archetypal kind of standpoint. For example, this guy did some work for Nike, apparently, and you probably did some of the stuff too. And he kind of found out the meaning there was, it was really the hero's journey. That's the deeper thing that people are resonating with. I mean, you kind of get your shoes on, you sweat, you go do great things. Hey, at the end, you won. Hero's journey. And so what we're kind of finding at our company so far, and we've done all these focus groups with customers and with employees, there seems to be something transformative going on where people feel transformed when they come to a Kimpton. And so there's a lot of reasons for that I haven't really got into, because I was talking too much here. But I think we're doing that for people. They actually, because of things we're doing, that they feel more in touch with who they really are at a core level after they experience a Kimpton Hotel, because of the design and because of the way our employees show up with them, genuine, and they get to be genuine back, that when they leave, they feel refreshed. They have kind of an identity refreshment. And again, I think it's something that other products would like to try to do, and I think are, because if you can use a product and feel better about who you really are at a core level, boy, that's powerful stuff. That really builds brands.
Well, what's really interesting about this is if the original question had to do with what's conscious, this doesn't happen by accident, and it's not just rhetoric, right? It's a careful, deliberately chosen goal to provide that for people, not just to provide a place for them to sleep for the night and have a decent meal, but to feel changed and improved, not necessarily in the sense of self-improvement, but elevated, right?
More in touch with who they really are.
I think it's important.
Who wouldn't
also
want that?
Like whenever we provide an experience, whenever we provide a product or a service, we are in fact packaging an experience, and we're either doing it consciously or not consciously. But I mean, the reality is that, at least in my experience of being in business, is we're in the business of crafting experiences, and you know, we're either doing it in a blind way or doing it in an extremely deliberate, very thoughtful way, that we're understanding that, you know, what we're doing has impact on people's lives, and we kind of have a sense of who it is we're talking to and how it is that they're appreciating what it is we're doing, right?
Right. So. And that's actually what we're trying to do, which I think is what your firm does, is trying to figure out, for those customers that really love you, why do they love you? And if you can figure it out, bottle it and do it again. And so we're trying not to be too... We're trying to be conscious about it, because I think you have to be deliberate about it. It's really about execution when you're in the service business. But you don't want to be insincere about it in any way. So it's kind of something we talked about in the kind of green room out here, is if you position yourself, for example, as a really socially responsible company, if you go out and put ads in the paper about it, for example, are you really setting yourself up for people to say, oh, they're not that socially responsible? If you're selling cigarettes or whatever you might be doing, you know, that you see all those ads out there. Well, here's this great company. Oh, by the way, don't they sell cigarettes?
This actually this relates to one thing. I was just working with a client last week, and we were trying to figure out how to articulate how they were going to provide real value for people. And there was a German expression, which I won't impose on you, but it basically is that if you say something flat out, the illusion's gone. Okay. So in this case, it's not really an illusion, it's a reality, but it begins to look unreal if you state it.
Well, and to play devil's advocate, there are people who are very intimidated by this kind of talk. I teach in several programs, and some of my students are extremely turned off by everything that we're talking about up here because they frame this as, oh, this is just more manipulation. This is more sophisticated ways of selling people things that they don't need, they don't want. It's more, you know, we haven't seen meaning washing yet, but I think we're probably 12 months out. How do you prevent, you know, the manipulation of this to illusion versus what you're clearly delivering is, you know, the authentic experiences that are truly meaningful. How do we differentiate the two?
Well, I've got one great example, and I don't think it was deliberate, but maybe it's a useful illustration of this. Right about the time that the book came out, a friend of mine who's the minister at the Unitarian Church in Sunnyvale invited me to come speak to his congregation about this idea. And I was a little apprehensive because I thought, going to talk about meaningful consumption in a church is a little presumptuous potentially. You know, it's like, well, where does meaning come from? It comes from spiritual practice. It comes from family life. It doesn't come from products necessarily, but we were claiming that, right? Or at least you could obtain it from that if it was done the right way. And I started talking with everybody, and nobody was throwing tomatoes or anything, but they were just kind of letting it sink in. And there was some silence. I talked for maybe 15 minutes about it, and there was silence. And then somebody said, I know exactly what you're talking about. I went out and bought a Prius. This was like, what, 2 years ago? And I went out and got it because of what this was about. And somebody else said, I tried to get one too, but they were sold out. I said, well, what made you think that the Prius was about this? They said, oh, well, it was obvious. They were selling it on the basis of it being economical because you'd spend less money on gasoline. But I could see as soon as it came out that it was really about saving the world. And in all the advertising for that car, there was never any mention about making the world a better place or being socially responsible by driving that car. They only focused on the fact that you could get 50 miles per gallon in the city. Now, that may be an example of not saying it flat out, but anybody who could see the idea behind it knew what it was right away. So how you present the idea could be very indirect. It could have nothing to do with what the ultimate benefit might be for you, but for you it might be self-evident.
Yeah. I think for us, one thing that helps keep what we do authentic is that everything we do comes from the bottom up. For example, our eco program, we've got 100 eco champions in our company that care, you know, really passionately about the environment. And so they're the ones on conference calls. They're the ones sending emails back and forth to each other. They're the ones saying, hey, listen, we got to do this or that. And from this group of people, we've adopted 40 different eco practices versus kind of from the top down, you hire a consultant and you say, hey, we got to do these four things. Let's work with the PR department, the marketing department, make sure everybody knows, put a couple ads out. And then nothing really happens because nobody really buys in. And that's also true as we think about, you know, how do we get involved with our communities? You know, we try to think about on a local level. Every one of our restaurants and hotels, you know, they pick their own causes that, you know, are important to them and their community so they can get a relationship with their community in a meaningful way. And then at a national level, we actually support three major causes at a national level that we donate the company's money to. We donate the, you know, restaurant space. We donate the hotel space. We give, you know, if people come in and say, I'm here for the Trust for Public Land, we take $10 from their stay and we give it to the Trust for Public Land. We have events at the hotel. And then it becomes more real, and then it's not just a marketing campaign or an advertising campaign. And if our employees tell us, you know, I don't want to do this anymore, well, we stop doing it.
I think you've hit on something that I think is critical for this within an organization, and that is if this talk lives within the marketing group or the branding group or never leaves the senior management, it's probably doomed to fail, and it's probably straight on the road to, you know, meaning washing or being inauthentic. You know, anyone in the branding world's been, you know, everyone in the branding world's been talking about authenticity for 9 or 10 years solid now. If it's what I see you do at Kimpton is really important, and that is you spend a lot of time with your employees, with the entire organization, learning from them about what they care about, helping them articulate what they care about, communicating what the values of the organization is. So in essence, everyone is a living embodiment of meaning, and you're helping them to be so. And that means every interaction they have with every customer, you know, there doesn't have to be an advertisement. It doesn't have to be branded with special logos. It doesn't have to be this sort of top-down, hit you on the head, make sure you don't miss it experience, because it is innate and it is everywhere and it's diffused through the whole organization, which makes it strong, which makes it authentic, and I think which then makes it meaningful.
But where do I send your check to?
Difference. Exactly. I was going to say, I got to separate you two. I think that there's a big difference between conscious capitalism that implies sort of this notion of sustainability and social venture versus authenticity from a branding perspective. And, so that's one comment. Two is I think that what I've been seeing, because being in the architecture business is a new thing for me, and I'm learning a lot, which is good for me and bad for those around me, apparently. But one of the things that I'm learning is that the clients, for example, with Michelle Kaufman, the early clients are the people who are really, this is their home, right? So it's when you're looking at some experience, packaging an experience, you know, creating somebody's physical home and making a safe place and making a healthy place is I don't know how to be. There's few things that can be more intimate than that and more impactful into somebody's life. It's really been lovely because in the last year and a half or so, I've had a chance to get to know some of the early customers. And coming from the tech business, I'm sure it's true for you too in the hotel business. That there are the early adopters, which I used to say are the people who, you know, you basically have a sign that says, if you're pregnant or have a heart condition, don't go on the ride. Because, you know, when you have a new offering, the cell phone doesn't work, the car, you know, I had friends who, I had a Insight and then a Prius, or as we call it in Berkeley, a Pius. and, you know, I've overpaid for most of the things I own because I'm either really dumb or an early adopter. That's what you get to call yourself, right? So the early adopters with, you know, for example, Michelle Kaufman, they're basically buying into the vision of both green, healthy living, but also the idea of you can scale this thing. You know, this is not about like, you know, free drinks for rich people or fancy greenhouses for rich people. This is the opportunity to take something that we can really learn together and then scale it in a kind of, you know, mass customization or factory way. And how do you do that and still keep the intimacy of what it takes to bring a home in and make it personal to you? If we can do it with a cell phone, you know, we can do it with a car, we have to be able to do it with a house. But it's really challenging.
But there's maybe an implicit difference in point of view among some of us about what it would mean to be a conscious capitalist, because uh-huh. I don't think that it necessarily requires, you don't even have to think about social responsibility whatsoever in order to address this question of meaning. Social responsibility is one way to be meaningful for people. If a client comes to one of us and says, can you explain to me how can I become authentic? You have a problem. But and
a very lucrative one.
A very lucrative one.
In his business.
But yeah, right, in my business. But it does turn out that most people who work for companies are big companies, Fortune 500 companies, global multinationals, actually do care about a wide variety of things, aside from they certainly care about value for stockholders, and that always is going to be there. The real question is, what else can they be about that would reinforce that or even enhance it? And is there a way to provide something beyond a functional benefit for people and still provide stockholders with what they need? And that we don't necessarily have to be talking about social responsibility. It can be about responsibility to deliver something really powerful to an individual who consumes something. So I just want to put that out there, because I don't think the conversation has to completely be centered on this idea of social responsibility, as important as it is, in order to be able to talk about how products and services can be better for us.
Yeah, you know, meaning, if we're talking about meaning, you're exactly right. And, you know, one thing that we've done on the meaning side, you know, the meaning in my view, and you're the experts, you guys wrote the book, is really about developing meaningful relationships, you know, meaningful experiences, but about relationship again. And on the corporate social responsibility side, or social responsibility side, we're thinking about relationships with our communities and relationship with various charities and whatnot. But we like to think about it also in terms of building that relationship with that employee, and that employee building that relationship with themselves. So this is kind of an idea, and I think we're talking about authenticity here quite a bit. And one way that we found to get authenticity is to create a work environment. Of course, we got 7,000 employees, so we've got a lot of employees for what we do. Other companies aren't like us necessarily, and we're in the service business, so maybe this just works especially good for us. But what we do is we help our employees be authentic and genuine by creating an environment that's inclusive, supportive, which is, you know, just kind of a given these days. But then we also provide them tools that help them connect with themselves. And one thing that we've used is something called the Enneagram, which is a tool, I don't know if people have heard about it, but it's kind of an ancient Sufi wisdom about how you different people's different personality types. And there's a lot of different ways to have people understand their personality types. But this particular one we like a lot because it basically breaks people into 9 different personality types with the idea that, you know, there's no bad personality types. You're really highly functioning within your personality type, or you're lowly functioning. If you're highly functioning, great. If you're lowly functioning, you might want to be aware of that and try to be a little more highly functioning. But the idea that if you can understand yourself better, understand the patterns of your own personality and behavior better, first you can understand your gifts, because everybody's got gifts. Work on those. Be aware of kind of the downside. But you're ultimately getting better connected to yourself. And as you get better connected to yourself, you're able to show up in a more authentic way with your coworkers, with your husband, your wife, your friends. And so I think, you know, kind of a, I don't know if this is social responsibility or not, but I think one of the benefits that people get from Kimpton, and I think it allows us to show up in an authentic way with our customers, because we don't script what they do with customers. We say, be yourself, is that they come to Kimpton thinking they're going to be better chefs or better general managers or whatnot. They actually leave, when they leave or stay, whatever, being better people. And Bill Kimpton had an idea that if we grow the people, we'll grow the organization. And so we spent a lot of time helping grow people. And matter of fact, everybody above chef and general manager level gets 10 hours one-on-one with a corporate psychologist that helps them understand their Enneagram type. And, you know, now that we're trying to typecast people, everybody can keep it to themselves if they want. I'm a 3, which is a doer. I like to do stuff. You know, I got a little checklist. I like to check it all off. And if you know I'm a 3, you know that, you know, pretty soon I'm going to feel like I got to go do something. So when I disengage from you, not personal, I got stuff to do. And so as people start to understand themselves better and understand other people better, and they self-declare, say, hey, I'm a 3, or I'm a 1, which is a perfectionist. You know, I know that perfectionist. Boy, they work for me in the legal department. Guess what? They get it all right. But, you know, I might have to watch them. If they're too much of a perfectionist, they might be there till midnight making sure that everything is dotted and I's dotted and T's crossed. Say, you know, it's okay now. You can go home. So, you know, just understanding this, is, I think it makes us a more conscious organization. And we really think a lot about having people grow. And, again, if they're in touch with themselves, they can be better in touch with customers and fellow workers.
Well, and so I'd like to make 2 points here. One is that, since we're here in San Francisco and we have representatives from Berkeley and probably Marin, we tend to talk about CSR and corporate responsibility and meaning. We tend to cast those into progressive terms or liberal terms. And as far as I'm concerned, meaning and values, the structure here is completely neutral. Hmm. So whether it's appropriate in this part of the country to connect meaning to social responsibility and sustainability in the environment, which may be completely appropriate, that doesn't mean that a meaning framework or meaningful experiences can't also connect with people that we would call conservative or whose values are about connecting to their God or to their nation or to all sorts of other values. Right. The system itself is neutral. It's about how you implement it and how you do it appropriately.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I think we better give Berkeley some equal time here.
Yeah. I was just going to say, if you follow that, I mean, then basically you're saying that it's about kind of, I mean, I hate to use the authenticity, so I'm looking for another word, but it's basically that I feel represented by, like, there's transparency in if I stay at a Kimpton hotel or if I, you know, buy a Prius or I, you know, whatever, go to this church, that I'm feeling that it's transparent. There's no surprises. It's representing, you know, who I either am or who I aspire to be. And so, you know, I think there's both a kind of self-knowledge and conscious choice on the part of the consumer, but the brand and the voice of the brand is transparent, right?
So, well, but if I can just throw one thing in, I think there's another dimension of it. As I was listening to you talk about how Kimpton operates, I couldn't help but think, well, are we talking about something that basically is the purview of upper middle class people who can afford to stay at this sort of place or to buy the Prius, right? There a
or
lot
the
of
custom home,
yeah,
or
right. Any of those things. I mean, we're all operating in those kinds of places to a large extent. I think it's really important to just point out that this is not limited to the West. It's not limited to people with some disposable income. It's applicable in lots of places. And I just want to give you an example because I think we can broaden this a little bit to show how it's actually necessary at a global level. It's not just a nice idea for those of us who can afford to pay a premium. Really good example. A colleague of mine was doing a project for Cemex, which is the concrete company that is out of Mexico. And they operate globally, but their headquarters is in Mexico. And they were observing that when they were trying to sell cement to people living in the shanty towns all around Mexico City, that people took 10 years to build one room onto their house. It took forever. It was expensive for individuals living in those places. They would save up. And they would never quite ever get it done. And they couldn't figure out what the problem was. So they hired this colleague, and she went in and spent a lot of time talking with people about what was going on. And it turned out that in order to build a house in that context, you didn't want to stand out like a sore thumb. So while it might only take 6 months to build a room, if you did that, you had one more room than your neighbor had, and you began to look like you were a social climber, and that was a problem within the context of that community. The idea within that community is that everybody needed to advance together. And these are, we're talking about people who didn't have much money, who would have to save up for a long period of time just to buy enough concrete to build a fairly small room addition to what they had. So Cemex came up with a program called Patrimonio Hoy that was based on the idea that you would build houses in a community context. So you had to bring together a group of friends and relatives who would contract with Cemex, and Cemex would provide guidance in how to build additional rooms on houses, and basically everybody worked together to build rooms for everybody else. And that was part of the deal that Cemex put together. And what it did was transform hundreds of thousands of people's lives all around Mexico City because they created a context that wasn't just about what you think of when you think about a raw material like concrete, that it's got functional value. It's something you put in a form and it allows you to build. But instead, it became part of community building. Now, you could say this was about social responsibility, but Cemex didn't approach it from that standpoint at all, and they weren't trying to prove that point through marketing or even with the people that they were selling the concrete to. They needed and wanted the market, and they made a lot of money from it because they increased demand really dramatically, but they did it in a way that provided meaning for people who lived in those communities. And so this is applicable whether you're looking at developing economies, whether you're talking about poor communities within the United States, or you're talking about upper middle class people. The real question is, do you set out to understand people at a really deep level and what they're really trying to get from the experience, in this case, of home, and that in Mexico, home has a social reality, not just a private one.
Community.
And so you build on that basis with people. I think that that's a really important part of this. So it doesn't have to look like social responsibility when you're doing it, but at the end of the day, it improves people's lives, and so it's hard to see that not being about social responsibility in some way. If it makes people's lives better, you're being socially responsible, I think, broadly speaking.
Good. Well, I had a question for Lisa, because I did want to hear about specifically socially responsible approaches to business. Now, in you've been in both in the high-tech world and the go-for-broke, go-for-money world, and also the not-for-profit foundation world. And Dos Margaritas sounds like a wonderful organization. Is there a trade-off between making profit and doing good for people in your world and the things that you've experienced and some of the boards you're on, like the New Resource Bank?
Yeah, I mean, thank you for the question. I think that certainly in the structure of Go for Broke, which isn't ever what we thought we were doing, but apparently we were. In that structure, you know, it is very, you are building a business, you are looking to grow a business, you're growing a relationship with a customer base and hopefully growing the class of characters that care about your brand, your offering, those sorts of things. In the nonprofit world, the way that it's structured very clearly, it's a whole different game, and it's a public benefit corporation by definition. The social venture, and so I've been personally frustrated over the last 15 years or so of trying to do both things at the same time. I've been attempting and failing at making a cocktail of those two things because one seems to be optimized for one thing. With Ofoto, for example, we created the Ofoto Foundation, and we did, you know, community-based things, and our customers and our employees participated in, you know, all those sorts. We tried to bake an element of that in, but my point is that, you know, social ventures, in potentially like New Resource Bank is a good example, Michelle Kaufman Company, the Squidoo is another good example, which is basically an organization that is a big website, and people are lens masters, and something you're passionate about, you create a web page, but it generates money, and that money you can decide goes to any charity. And so Squidoo has, over the last few years, raised, I actually am not current on the amount of money, or I would state it, but it's over $500,000 for charities. So it's playing, you know, this business of understanding how to, you know, play the cocktail. One of the interesting things that I've seen in the last really 2 years, both on the tech and media business and the emerging green businesses, as well as with nonprofits, and I'll talk about some of the things we do with Dos Margaritas really fast, but there's an emerging of venture firms, especially in the Bay Area, but I'm also aware of in Colorado and in New York and Boston, who are also trying to make this cocktail of, because they're pushing the question of, do you really have to make a trade-off between profit and social benefit? And I think that, you know, there is a friction there, certainly, but it's the same as if I'm part of a publicly traded company like AOL or Kodak, it was very different than if we're, you know, GNN or Ofoto. You can very much, and it's the same with Kimpton, I'm quite certain, is, you know, when you're a public corporation, you're obligated to pay a lot of attention to your shareholders, and what's always to the best benefit of the shareholder isn't to the best benefit of your employees or your customers. So there is always a trade-off, and in this case, there's a number of venture firms like New Cycle Capital and Triple Bottom Line Capital here, and a couple other ones that have double bottom line, triple bottom line, they both exist, who are, you know, doing these sorts of things, making investments in ventures that they think, like Numi Tees and Michelle Kaufman and companies like that, where they see like this really great product that also has some public happiness. With respect to Dos Margaritas, it's a 501c3, but we tried really hard to create it being a sustainable thing, so we wouldn't have to do, like, the business model wasn't designed to be perpetual begging. And so it's been challenging, you know, but we basically, except for the volcano that seems to be erupting extremely close to one of our big projects at the moment in Patagonia, Chile, you know, we've been quite successful at creating products, essentially, that allow the organization to continue to sustain itself, which is, and another good model that we won't talk about, but if people are interested in, should check out, is the Acumen Fund, which is an organization that is really interesting in kind of creating a venture firm for really focusing on things like clean water and clean air and food and things like that, health products that support you know, Africa and Asia as two key markets. So they've taken a venture capital model and applied it to nonprofits and to really important regions of the world in an interesting way.
Well, thank you. Now, Mike, I had one question, and then I'm going to turn it over to audience questions. But now you guys at Kimpton talk a lot about your employees and working from the ground up and everything, but do all those people working in the Kimpton hotels buy into your corporate stuff, or is this a sort of a happy washing, or I'm not sure what the right term would be, but how do you ensure that the people who are washing dishes or who are the bellmen at a hotel are going to buy into your
We have 7,000 employees, so not every single one of our employees buys in to the same extent. And I guess my view is in an organization is that you've got just the whole organization. You've got 10% of the true believers, no matter what you say. It's like Christy back there. They're happy. Sorry, Christy. Everything I say, they believe. And then there's 10% are the non-believers. Doesn't matter what you say, they don't believe you. And then there's that 80% in between. And so part of management's job is to swing that 80%. They're not going to become true believers, but you're going to swing the momentum over that way and then try to get rid of the non-believers. So the culture in our company, I think, is very strong. And it's such that I know when people come in and we interview them, I always say to them, I say, listen, you're technically confident you wouldn't be here. Your biggest challenge is to fit in culturally, because the culture of this company is so strong. If you don't fit in culturally, this culture will spit you out, and it really will. People come to me and say, it doesn't fit. That person doesn't fit. And so, we're not perfect by any means, but I think we have a very strong culture. And if I was to really pinpoint the key success factor or the secret sauce of Kimpton, it's a really strong culture, and one we guard very carefully and one we really nurture and take care of. But, we're in the hospitality business. We're hospitable. That's how we treat people. So people want to come work for us and stay with us. And even if we've got the Hispanic housekeeper or whatever it might be, we've got people that kind of, they get it. They want to be part of it. And those that don't, they leave or they're asked to leave.
I think you
could probably say that about every great company or most great companies.
I think you could, yeah. Not everybody drinks the Kool-Aid. But I'd say a lot of people do, and we're trying to be authentic about it, so we're not trying to have people drink the Kool-Aid. And I'm finding that we're attracting more and more people to the company just based on what the company stands for and what we do.
Okay, well, Steve, I'm going to ask you the first of the questions here, because you and I were talking about politics earlier, and so this is a political question. A more conscious capitalism requires more conscious consumers. And this question is open to all the panelists, but I'm going to start with Steve. A more conscious capitalism requires more conscious consumers. What are the roles and limitations of business in this stuff, in this shift, in other words, versus government, NGOs, education, et cetera? What are the roles and limitations of business in this shift?
Do you mean in terms of helping people understand the possibilities, or do you mean just...
I don't know. I just read you the question from the audience. Oh. You're going to have to go from here.
All right.
Oh.
Well, I think in some ways it's actually pretty simple. There is the question of being able to be authentic about something. So if you stand for nothing and there's this whole question of knowing who you are, which you were talking about before, and companies need to know that too. But it's not just a matter of expressing some idea. It's about expressing something that's heartfelt and that a company knows people want. So I think the first thing is that when virtually every company starts out, they understand something important about what people want. And as they get larger and society changes, they can lose touch very easily. So the most important starting point is stay in touch. There's lots of talk about how the CEO of JetBlue would fly on the planes and serve people to see how what the actual experience is like after the company got to be pretty large. That's a great example of staying in touch with the people that you're trying to serve. You need to know what matters to them at a deep level, and you have to, I think, be fairly ambitious about trying to satisfy something that may be difficult to satisfy. So a company has an obligation, if they're trying to accomplish this, by first knowing who they want to be, and then second of all, just as important, not less, not more, but just as important, understanding what people want from the experience of interacting with a company like this, what's possible, and then systematically setting out to provide it. Once they start providing it, I don't think that a company has to do much more than that. I don't know what Kimpton's marketing strategy has been, but what I've heard over the years is that people would stumble onto it through word of mouth. They stay once, they're sold.
It's totally PR driven, so it's word of mouth.
Well, so word of mouth will come from just people having experiences and sharing it with people. So I think the most important thing, again, is having conscious awareness of those factors and then setting out to act on them in a systematic way.
But I'm gonna jump in because there's something structural here that's much deeper that needs to be addressed in our culture, and that is that companies are legally prevented from valuing anything more than money. We have a legal structure in this country that says you can't value values more than you value money, or else you can have a shareholder lawsuit and you've broken your fiduciary trust with the stakeholders, et cetera. And Lisa's been talking about trying to mix these two cocktails and have a company that has values and have a 501c3 that, you know, that is run well and has a sustainable, you know, financial model, and that's something that really needs to change in our culture. And right now in our state, we actually have an assembly bill that's coming up where people are trying to break that legal mechanism and allow companies to have values. And we have moments in our past when it's been okay for companies to have values other than money. When there was a time in this country when we were at war, when it's not okay, for instance, to sell things to the enemy, right? It certainly wasn't during World War II. Apparently it is okay now. So even the most hardcore business people recognize the need for values when it comes up, and that sometimes values are more important than the profit or the bottom line. But we have this limitation that's preventing businesses from being more conscious.
Okay, I've got a comment on this. Just the business guy. Hold on. Companies with values, oh my gosh, that's all about making money. If we went and decided to give away 10% of our net profit, I'm not sure we might actually do better. You may be talking about something further theoretical, but the reality is that shareholders trust management to do the right thing. And Google gives money to their foundation. Nobody's saying, hey, Google, you can't do that. It's against the law. They're doing it because they trust those guys that they're doing the right thing.
That's a bad specific example, because it's actually not the way it happened.
It's written in their bylaws,
correct.
Which is very unique.
Correct.
I mean, there's
a whole other. There's two things I'd like to say. One is that I think we, as a culture, tend to value we value and we assess cost at the time of a transaction, not through the lifetime of the product or service. And I think that concept is really, really important and seems really trivial, but when you look at, for example, you know, what shoes to buy or what clothes to wear or what car to buy or what kind of energy to use or what kind of cell phone, like if you're going to big chain stores and making choices on the basis of cost alone at the time of the cash register, you know, for example, the energy that you use in your house, the system that you have, the freezers that you have or whatever, may end up being far more costly operationally over the life, the windows, the doors, all those sorts of things. And we as a culture just tend to assess cost and value in a very in a snapshot as opposed to the whole movie. And I think that we rip ourselves off doing that, but we also rip off the community, and it creates the business making also decisions that create a disposable economy, which I think we know isn't like the most brilliant two words that ever went together. The second thing is that there is just as a comment, and I'm not an expert in this, but we've started to research that there is something now called a B Corp. You know, there's a C Corp, there's LLCs, there's all kinds of structures. There's a B Corp, which for me is a legal distinction, actually, but in many ways it's also poetic. In that, you know, it's basically like the bylaws of Google and with Ofoto and other companies, you could choose to do certain things and to behave certain ways. And if you bake it in, then it's kind of in the fabric of what you then build, and it's the water you drink, etc. With respect to a B Corp, there's a growing number of companies and communities who are signing up for that, and you can go and look at, I don't know if the website is really bcorp.com, but you can,
org maybe.
org maybe, yeah. Well, anyway.
But a lot of this, a lot of the conversation that's happening right now is it seems to me to be focused on, again, this idea of social responsibility at all levels in the purchasing process in terms of what the effect is socially on what a company provides. If we step away from that for a second and just ask, is it possible for, if you take the Cemex example, for instance, there was no contradiction there. There was no difficulty in increasing profit and at the same time improving the way that whole communities live.
But I have a comment, which is basically the Cemex thing I happen to be intimately involved with. Okay. And, you know, they were running out of market because the economy was really tough in Mexico City, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of crime, and there was a lack of financial ability for people to expand their homes. And they looked into the possibility of doing special kinds of loans and different financial instruments, and they created this as a kind of financial instrument to drive, you know, cash flow and profit.
But they had a great outcome.
They had a great outcome.
And all I'm talking about is that the outcome was not inconsistent with providing value to stockholders. So I don't, and I'm not positioning myself within this group as the uber capitalist by any means, but I do think that it isn't necessarily. I don't think it's fair to say that there's always going to be some kind of compromise, or that there's some sort of inherent contradiction between providing value for people,
correct,
individually who are buying your products, and social outcomes. So there can be, but there doesn't have to be all the time. And companies can look for opportunities to provide value for individuals at a much higher level than they do right now, which is an aspect of providing conscious benefits for people, and at the same time, at least not doing no harm. And in order to do that, they need certain ideas at their fingertips to ask new questions about what's possible within the market. And I just think Cemex is an interesting example of asking new questions to try to find new opportunities.
Can I comment on the just what we're talking about here, how we see as a for-profit company, how we see the business case for being eco-sensitive? The way we think about it, besides the fact it's just the right thing to do, is kind of number one. Secondly, it's about, you know, being ecologically sensitive is usually about being a good steward of the resources you have, which means saving resources. So in our case, in our hotel, it's about saving water, it's about saving energy, it's about recycling, spending less money on that. And we actually save a fair amount of money by being eco-sensitive. And then for us also, number three, it's about attracting guests. We find that 16% of our guests said they stay with us because of our eco programs, which is rather astounding. So that's important. And then probably overlooked by a lot of people is it's really important in attracting great employees. We find the kind of employees that care about the environment, they're the kind of employees that care. And we want people to care. And they're also the kind of people that stay with us. And so, you know, those are the business reasons we do it. It happens to be the right thing to do, but there's a great business case for it. We don't feel like we're making any trade-offs at all.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, well, unfortunately, we've reached the time in our program right now where we only have time for one more question. And I'm going to read an audience question, and I'd like each of you to respond to it. And Lisa, I'll let you pick the order that people respond to.
Let's hear the question first.
Please talk about the biggest challenges or constraints to operating in a conscious manner. What are the things that you wish you could do but aren't currently able to do so? I think you could, you yourself or people that you work with, clients, so either companies you consult with or you're on the board for or your own company. So Mike, why don't you start?
Okay, well, I think one thing that's topical for us is all the new hotels that we do, we'd like them to be LEED certified. But it's expensive. So we're doing a project right now in Philadelphia that's going to cost about $2 million more to be LEED certified. We're actually going to do it. But we have 18 projects in our pipeline. And so looking at all that, not all of them will make economic sense to turn into LEED certified. And in some cases, we manage for third parties, so we can't dictate what they do. But I would like to be able to build everything in the future LEED certified. I think we're going that way anyway. But it is right now, it's about anywhere from 2 to 10% more in cost. And so it's cost prohibitive. But we always make the economic case that, hey, we're going to get more people that are going to come in, so we're going to get higher occupancy. They'll probably pay a higher rate because they really like this, so they'll pay a lower rate. We're going to save some money. That all works. And hopefully we come up with an economic case that makes sense, besides, again, the fact that it's the right thing to do.
Thank you. Nathan, do you want to respond?
Yeah, I think there's maybe two things that I'll add into that.
Pull the mic over.
And that is that as a consumer, at least, these choices are really difficult. The experts can't figure out and tell you which is better for the environment or for workers in, you know, Southeast Asia, this or that, the Prius, the Hummer. These are really complex calculations that take into account full life cycle. When you're sitting there in the aisle and you're just trying to decide, you know, which spaghetti sauce is going to match my values, there's no way to tell right now. And so you're sort of left to hearsay or, you know, maybe some experts say something, Greenpeace might, you know, weigh in, PETA, whatever, but nobody really, it's very difficult to find out at this point. So we have a ways to go before that becomes easier for people to vote their pocketbooks around their values or their meaning, et cetera. The other thing on a corporate level is that while it's possible to do things that are make more meaningful experiences or operate in a way that's more meaningful both inside the company and with your customers, it's not exactly a level playing field yet. It would be nice if there were, I'm not a huge fan of regulations, but it would be nice if the government took the opportunity to level the playing field so that it wasn't an issue for corporations. We acted like this. We do this way. It's no longer an issue, and we're all just going to, you know, move on and compete over more important or more meaningful experiences that we're going to provide, not over, you know, arbitrage on gas prices because the total cost of gasoline isn't actually at the pump or whatever.
Lisa, would you like to respond?
Sure. I agree with Nathan, of course, on the on the consumer piece, because I think that in general, when there's disruption and there's new stuff and there's just a lot of confusion for normal people, which alternative days I consider myself, but you know, then you standing in the aisle or you're at the car lot or whatever, you're trying to make a decision. You do the best research you can, and it's really a question of, you know, who are you trusting to, who's influencing you, and what's the time frame that you're thinking in? And there's just a lot of questions, and it's hard to spend money consciously. And the second thing from a business perspective that I've experienced that I see with Michelle Kaufman's company most recently, I imagine that Kimpton has on a regular basis as well, is that, you know, we're looking at things saying, for example, LEED is a good example. We could deliver homes that are LEED, but we're trying to also be super accessible to take pre-configured homes, not just do custom, you know, really high-end homes, but create this experience that's very accessible broadly. And so there's ways that you add, the more things you add into the box, the more, you know, you make yourself inaccessible. And so there's this whole process, and it has to do with the life cycle of a whole market, that right now we're in the process of things being sourced differently and changed and patterns and regulatory and other things that will really change the ability for us to bring, like in 5 or 10 years, we'll stop talking about sustainability, I think. We'll stop talking about green because it will have hopefully happily influenced and polluted and pervaded and invaded pretty much everything that we do and touch. And so the idea is just that from a market perspective and as a marketer and as an entrepreneur, we look at what's the right moment in time to start bringing in different pieces and to continue to make the product and the category richer and deeper without making it inaccessible. And if you start with, you know, high-end customers at Kimpton or high-end clients at Michelle Kaufman, you don't want to alienate those people as you start to broaden the market. And so it's a challenge.
Thank you very much. Steve, would you like to
Sure. Give
us your thoughts on this to wrap it up?
Yeah, sure. I think that there's two dimensions to it for me that are really key. One is, as a problem, most companies that we see operating right now are profoundly ignorant about what really matters to people. So they have to go out and actually live with people where they are and see what makes life worth living for people. And that's not just about social responsibility. It's all of these range of things that matter to each of us individually that we think about that drives us to and makes our lives better. Can cat litter be meaningful? You know, it's easy to see how cars are marketed as if they're about that, but can a more banal kind of product be about that too? It may be possible, but does the manufacturer ever ask the question? If they ask the question, it leads them to a whole different range of issues that they can explore when they spend time with people. So I think that's the first thing, is that most companies are largely ignorant about what makes life worth living for their customers. The second thing is that even if they do get a glimpse of it, most corporations aren't organized to actually address something like that. They're organized into silos that don't speak to each other. And so if marketing thinks that this is a great idea, the people doing innovation have no direct contact with them, and so they don't even think about it. So ultimately, a lot of this has to do with innovating new solutions for people that require a deep understanding of consumers, and then people have to talk to each other within big corporations. It's not that they don't want to think about it, it's that they don't even have the mechanisms to talk to each other. So a lot of what we try to do is figure out ways to bring people together within these corporate settings so that they can do it. A company like Kimpton is organized for everybody to talk with each other about this core value that they're trying to deliver. We just think it's important for more companies to try to do that, and they can be a company with 7,000 employees or with 70 or with 700,000. The challenges are just different, and how to pull it together so that people can begin to share these ideas rather than small groups within a company doing it and then it not leading to anything.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, I want to thank all of our panelists today here at Conscious Capitalism Part 2, Nathan Shedroff, Lisa Gansky, Steve Diller, and Mike DePatey. And I also want to thank our audience for attending. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Very enlightened.